Good afternoon. It's a real pleasure to be here, and I'm afraid this is going to be a bit of a horse race, but we'll try to get right to it. I'm going to be talking about opportunities for applied marker-assisted breeding in sorghum, in large part because I think that we really need to make use of this tool in order to make the genetic gains that we really need to be making in the near future. My presentation will talk a little bit about where we've come from and where we need to go, looking at a number of different marker or biotechnology-assisted crop improvement methods, and how markers can fit into all of those. Then look at some of the germplasm collections, wild and cultivated materials, what we need to be using there. I'll talk about marker-assisted selection. I'll focus on marker-assisted backcrossing, although marker-assisted recurrent selection, marker-assisted population improvement, and genome-wide selection are all probably very relevant as well. Then look briefly at a number of the different genomic tools that are available, and then give some examples from marker-assisted breeding in sorghum opportunities and examples. I won't talk about the pearl millet because I've decided I don't have time to do that, so it's been cut out. So where have we come from in breeding sorghum bicolor? Sorghum is a drought-tolerant, self-pollinated diploid, basically small genome maize with lots and lots of variability, although not as much variability as in maize. In the 1930s and onwards, there was considerable work on Mendelian genetic studies, flowering plant height, grain quality, and from this we got the combine height sorghums that became popular in the dry areas in the Midwest, Kansas, Nebraska, Oklahoma, Texas. The discovery of the myelinal cytoplasmic male sterility system in the 1950s led to rapid adoption of combine height F1 hybrids here in the U.S. We went from 0% hybrids to 90% hybrids in 4 years. And similar developments have been seen in related markets around the world. Subsequent diversification of elite gene pools globally, with 00 germplasm from Sudan and Ethiopia in East Africa, contributed dramatic gains to yield potential. But then, from about mid-1970s onwards, yield gains have slowed as breeding is focused on overcoming biotic and abiotic constraints. This information on this is well documented. Bill Rooney published a nice paper in Advances in Agronomy in 2004. And I refer people to that if they're interested. Following the introduction of earlier maturing F1 hybrids in India in the 1970s, rainy season sorghum grain yields in India have stagnated. And in fact, the crop area has gone down. And the reason is because grain mold. By shortening the duration, we brought the maturity of the grain into the rainy season. The only people that are benefiting from this now are the distillers who are getting low-cost grain that nobody else wants to buy, and they're turning it into whiskey. And they like that because it takes one day less to process the grain because it's already partially processed by the grain mold fungi. Other things that have contributed to the problem have been subsidized wheat and rice prices, food grain prices, more valuable a lot of government emphasis on increasing oilseed production, predominantly soybean, and more recently BT cotton. However, the area has now stabilized at about 5 million hectares of rainy season sorghum per year, and it's due to the needs for fodder of the peri-urban dairy industry, and also increased interest in sweet sorghum, possibly for ethanol production. But if ethanol production biofuels doesn't turn out to be a good way to go, they will process it with dairy cattle, and they'll still make more money. And so this is a picture of Bellum Reddy, Ikrasat sorghum breeder who will be retiring in the not too distant future, along with some of his nursery material this past year. Another sorghum breeder that some of you may know, the late Darrell Rosenau, next to some taller material that's more like the sorghums that continued to dominate traditional sorghum production areas in Africa, the Middle East, the dry season, the post-rainy season sorghums in India, and as well as the sorghums in Central America. There, farmers continue to grow matrils that are approximately 2 meters tall or more. In Central America, some of them go to 4.5 meters, as they do in some of the pictures we saw from Nigeria earlier this afternoon. Crop biotechnology is now, we've been paying a lot for this for the last 20 years, and it's time to start reaping some rewards. The stated intention of all of the work that's been done on crop biotechnology since the mid-1980s has been to improve plant breeding program efficiency. But to date, we don't have that much to show for it, especially in developing countries. The crops are coming along now where marker-assisted breeding is becoming possible in the crops where investment in the tools has been done, but it's been at great expense. Luckily, with new technologies that are coming, it'll soon be possible for all crops. Biotech approaches include wide crosses, mutation and reverse genetics, use of DNA markers, and transgenics. And molecular markers can be used to facilitate all of this. As an example, show some transgenic sorghums, salinity-tolerant transgenic sorghums at the Director of Sorghum Research in Hyderabad. They also have some very nice BT events that are showing superb resistance to stem borers, which will make sweet sorghum a much more viable crop in the future. I'm now going to go back to some fairly basic things. Marker-assisted breeding involves two fairly closely related activities, and in the best of both worlds, both of them are occurring simultaneously. You've got the genetic mapping and your marker-assisted breeding. Move into the details of the marker-assisted breeding. This involves choosing your donor and elite parents, marker polymorphism assessment, breeding population production, DNA sampling of every individual being considered for advance, genotyping each of those individuals, doing foreground, sometimes with or without background selection, and then rapidly moving your generations along. Or you can either very rapidly move the generations along, or you can take a little bit more time and maybe do more marker data generation and fewer generations to try to reduce the total amount of time that you need to recover your elite products for testing. And I'll just skip through that one because I think we're all familiar with that. Genotyping with flanking markers is much more powerful than genotyping with perfect markers. And I've had enough of molecular biologists telling me that we need perfect markers. We don't need them. We really do not need them. I don't want them. They're too expensive. And if I've got the perfect marker, what happens if I have a recombination very, very close to my perfect marker? Maybe I lose half the gene that I'm interested in. I'm much better off having a pair of flanking markers where I know that I'm moving this bit in the middle. So I would prefer to have one or two flanking markers above my target QTL and one or two markers below my target QTL, and then try to use those to move things along. Ideally, we'd like to have a large population. In order to reduce the number of generations, I want to produce 1,000 Backcross 1 F1 individuals. So I want to have 1,000 individuals to check for marker genotypes at these four loci flanking my target QTL. In that first Backcross generation, I look for individuals that are heterozygous at the two loci most closest to the allele, and I want a recombination either here or here, and I don't care where. I then advance. I take 100 of those, 100 recombinants out of that 1,000 individuals, and hit them with any kind of marker that I can that gives me background information to speed up the recovery of elite alleles across the genome. I can use AFLP, DART, SNPs, or genotyping by sequencing type markers, and identify two or three individuals out of my population of 1,000 that are heterozygous at BND and have the smallest percentage of donor parents genome elsewhere across the entire genome, and advance those two or three selected individuals. I then repeat the exercise selecting for recombination on the other side so that I end up with something that's homozygous elite on either end, heterozygous for a little bit in the middle, and advance those individuals, I may or may not need to do background selection in this generation, depending upon how successful I was the previous one. And by the time that I finish, I then grow out small Macross 2F2 populations, find the introgression homozygotes, and I have finished products, five generations from the time that I started my crossing program. These have very small introgressions. They're ready for evaluation as lines per se or in test crosses. And this permits completion of my first phase of my marker-assisted back crossing in just five generations. So that's real time savings. Only one problem. It requires very large Backcross 1 and F and Backcross 2 F1 populations. And if I'm working with sorghum or finger millet or lentils or just about any other self-pollinated crop, getting those large populations is a problem. So breeders have a tool. In almost any crop, you already have genetic Melstroli. And if you don't have it already, you can induce mutations for genetic Melstroli and then move those into your elite genetic backgrounds. Use those as tools to facilitate this production of your large Backcross 1 and Backcross 2 F1 populations. Once you have those, you can take your genetic male sterile and elite genetic background, cross that to any trait donor or diversity donor, move that quickly into a fairly elite genetic background, and from your Backcross 1 F1, self the interesting individuals, use your eyes, the power of your testing environments, to identify the interesting individuals, self those, and take those into hedgerows. The ones that are interesting and look interesting in hedgerows, you can then genotype with a full genome scan to find out where in the world the interesting genes are coming from. So that's my idea of how, and it's not my idea alone, I think it's a fairly global idea of how we can make, how we can integrate marker-assisted breeding into a conventional breeding program. But how can we make this even more practical and cost-effective? Cheaper and easier DNA isolation has been a big problem, but I think that's now nearly solved. We have methods that are good enough for PCR reactions. They aren't quite good enough for DART or genotyping by sequencing type operations, but it's basically fast becoming a reality. Reliable marker data that takes less time to obtain. Service labs are out there. SSR, SNPs, DARTs, genotyping by sequencing markers will all be possible and available to all plant breeders globally in a very short time. What we don't have, where the big problems are at present, is in data tracking. Keeping track of which DNA sample came from which plant, which marker data came from which DNA sample, which marker data then relates back to which seed packet that you harvested. And keeping track of that is the biggest problem of all. And marker-assisted breeding is very unforgiving. It tells you every time you've screwed up, and it tells you very, very loudly. And I know, I've got a lot of practice. So I'd like to move on now to sorghum for a few minutes. Sorghum is the fifth most important cereal globally. It's grown throughout the semi-arid tropics and hot semi-arid parts of the temperate regions. It's grown for grain, for human consumption and animal feed, silver for feed, fuel, and construction material, biomass for fodder and biofuels. So it's a true multi-purpose food, feed, fuel crop, much like maize. Targets for marker-assisted breeding in the past have largely been genetic diversity assessment. We're starting to work now on combining ability grouping, but we've made quite a bit of headway on certain traits, including drought tolerance and some pest resistances. Things for the future include grain mold, salinity tolerance. Acid soil tolerance is a place where we now actually have the gene, and we've been able to do allele mining for aluminum tolerance at the locus that contributes most of the variation there. Grain and silver yield and quality traits, sweet sorghum productivity traits, grain protein digestibility, and grain micronutrient density are all potential targets of marker-assisted breeding, just as they are for conventional breeding. We've got wonderful genomic tools now available in sorghum. We have an annotated aligned sorghum genome sequence on which we've recently been able to put over 7,500 SSR loci by in silico means using publicly available primer sequences, blasting them against the genome sequence, identifying where they should go. And when we then go try and use them, use the new ones, That's usually where they turn out to map to. We've got tilling populations, eco-tilling populations, dart arrays, SNP arrays, and high-throughput sequencing-based markers are on the way. Mapping populations, I've got a little bit of a mix-up here. We've got conventional biparental mapping populations, lots of them. I'm harvesting 10 of them, or 10 of them are being harvested for me as I speak here. We've got nested association mapping populations here in the U.S., and I'm developing MAGIC populations in India. Backcross NAM, backcross nested aligned, nested association mapping populations are under development for some breeding programs in Africa with funding from the Generation Challenge Program. So the most powerful tool that we definitely have, the most powerful tool that we have today is the annotated aligned sorghum genome. And the major difference that came out of this is that the difference between sorghum and rice is that sorghum has four times as much heterochromatin. Everything else is about the same. A lot of it even lines up. But this area in the middle, where you've got lots of repeat elements, is what's much bigger in sorghum. And I expect that I haven't seen the sequence, looked at the sequence in detail for maize, but I expect that there it's even bigger. And if you want to really see a lot of such material, probably go to onions or other alliums, which have enormous genomes and probably don't have that many more genes than any other crop. So if we look at this, this is looking at sorghum chromosome 6, and we see the genes are, we have a lot of genes on the long arm, a few genes on the short arm, and 35 megabase pairs of almost nothing in between. So we expected that we would have very few, if any, sorghum EST SSRs, and about the same time that the EST, or that the aligned genome sequence came available, we had just developed 600 EST SSRs, so we were able to blast those against the aligned sequence and see where they went. And lo and behold, we had a very small number up at the top, a big gaping hole in the middle, and a lot of new EST marker, EST SSR markers down at on the long arm of the chromosome. And most of these, of course, had homology with rice chromosome 4. And so what's this big gap? Is it important? Yes, it's very important, because our major photoperiod sensitivity gene and one of our major dwarfing genes land right in the middle of that. And there's almost no recombination in that 35 megabase pairs. Very, very low levels of recombination. So how do we deal with that? That's one of the sorts of things that we need to work with in future. But first, we need to identify the gene, then we can go hunting for allelic variants there, and we should be able to manipulate this much more effectively in future than we have been able to in the past. So my group has recently put these 6,500 SSR primer pairs onto the aligned map. We tested 7,500. 6,500 had single unique positions on the genome. 5,000 of these were from genomic libraries, and another 1,400 were from EST sequences. There are now a number of other papers that were in the process of pulling the sequences from those out and putting them on the aligned sequence. And if we run into trouble, we've got 71,000 more primer pairs that are hidden in the supplemental data from the sorghum genome sequence paper. This is what the sequence looks like, or this is what our sorghum SSR map looks like right now, and it's pretty reasonable coverage for most of the genome. If we want to go to a place, say here on linkage group 6, long arm of linkage group 6, last week, there was a paper published in Euphytica identifying a major gene for multiple disease resistance, multiple foliar disease resistances. It co-segregates with the plant color locus, but if you want to use SSR markers to move the recessively inherited tan plant color, which is associated with the resistance, into other genetic backgrounds, here's 25 SSRs, in a 1 centimorgan, or excuse me, a 1 megabase pair region that we can use for moving that in there. It's a really powerful tool. Other things that we've got, we have DART platforms, one developed in Australia, one developed at Ikrasoc. And between these, we probably have 1,500 to 2,000 markers that we can use for background selection. We have a small Illumina chip that can be used for background selection for other purposes. And thanks to an NSF RED project led by Ed Buckler. We are rapidly moving towards having very large numbers of sequencing by genotyping markers. We're expecting to be able to generate 400,000 markers per DNA sample for less than $20. And that will mean genome-wide selection is not only cheap and easy to do, but you better do it, because if you don't do it, somebody else is going to do it and your breeding program is going to be out of business. I don't have any sorghum data to show, so I'll show large genome cross-pollinated sorghum, also known as maize. This is 3,600 genotyping by sequencing SNPs on one chromosome of maize. And I'm going to be receiving similar data from Ed Buckler's group in December for my first 1,000 DNA samples. Sorghum tilling populations are available, but I don't think that these are going to be that powerful for that long. Eco-tilling is going to be much more powerful, and we have very nice populations that can be used for this purpose. With funding from the Generation Challenge Program, CIRID and Microsoft collaborated with Chinese partners, providing some germplasm, to look at the global structure of sorghum germplasm. And we were able to identify, this is what we got after genotyping almost 3,400 accessions with 41 SSRs distributed across all 10 sorghum linkage groups. We had ended up identifying very nice region-based sets of germplasm. And if we go to the races, you can also see very nice associations there. Biggest trouble for me, being based in India, trying to meet the Indian environment needs, is that almost all the sorghum in India is dhurra, and it's almost all of it is very, very closely genetically related. We cannot get good heterosis just by breeding, crossing Indian adapted material with adapted material. We have to go elsewhere. But this information tells us where to go. Anything that's pink on here is dhurra. We can get the grain quality that we need, a lot of the grain quality characteristics and some of the insect resistances that we need by going to those other sources of dhurra germplasm. We can probably get heterosis there as well. We have a subset now. That subset can be used as our association panel. And if 384 entries is too many, we can go give you a representative subset of 48. We're basically now ready to do allele mining in sorghum, and using this panel, Cornell University and the Brazilians have recently done allele mining, completed allele mining for the Alt-SB gene associated with lumen tolerance, and we have many other targets. I'd like to touch base briefly before closing on some of our marker-assisted backcrossing work. We've been working on Striga resistance. We have materials ready to go farm there. We've been working with Stagreen. Stagreen does something for drought tolerance, but even more important, it improves straw quality for livestock. And as Dr. Pixley indicated, dairymen are willing to pay good money for better quality straw. So we can put more money in farmers' pockets just by breeding their crop to be green. Breeding it to be green alone, though, isn't enough. It also has to, this is Stay Green sorghum in an unadapted background. Shoot fly got it. This is the local check behind it. So things that we've got to be doing this in an integrated manner. One bullet isn't going to solve the problem. We've got lots of different target traits where we're well advanced, and many more on the way. With that, I think that I've exhausted my time, and I'd like to thank the Global Sorghum Research Technology Delivery and Producer Communities for sharing the information that I've presented here. I'd also like to thank donors supporting this work, including Asian Development Bank, Australian Council for International Agricultural Research, German funding agency, BMZ, Indian Department of Biotechnology, UK's Department for International Development, Department of Energy here in the United States, Generation Challenge Program, Harvest Plus, Indian Council of Agricultural Research, National Science Foundation, USAID, and the World Bank, and many others. And finally, I'd like to thank Crop Science for giving me this opportunity to speak to you, to each of you here today, and for each of you for your kind attention. Thank you very much.